This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Dungarees, blue drillins, Levi's, whatever you call them, jeans, are an American icon worn by miners, cowboys, rebels, movie stars, and just about everyone else. On the program today, we're going to take a closer look at our denim trousers. Our guest is journalist James Sullivan. He is the author of Jeans, A Cultural History of an American Icon. Early in the book, Sullivan says, no matter where they're made, no matter what we pay for them, a pair of jeans, in his words, embodies two centuries worth of the myths and ideals of American culture. Jeans are the surviving relic of the Western frontier. They epitomize our present-day occupations, celebrity and consumer culture, and will likely be wearing them long after the business suit, say, has been relegated to the dustbin of fashion. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, James Sullivan. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. James Sullivan was a pop culture critic at the San Francisco Chronicle for 7 years. His writing has appeared in several other publications, including the Boston Globe and Rolling Stone. Again, the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Jim Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What is it about the blue jean that it has such staying power?
Well, besides the fact that blue jeans are actually made to be durable, to be a durable product, they are, in fact, a durable product in the larger sense. I think that one of the main keys to their success over so many years is the fact that every generation of the last several has found a way to alter jeans in just enough so that they're different than their parents' generation of jeans. In other words, jeans are endlessly transformable. The jeans that we recognize today are essentially the same thing that was rolling off the first assembly lines at Levi Strauss & Company 130 years ago, and yet every generation has found a way to wear them differently than their parents and make them their own.
Yeah. What are some of the ways jeans have been refashioned generation to generation?
Well, from, you know, beginning in the 40s and 50s when teenagers began turning the jeans industry into something other than a workwear industry, it was really teenagers and young adults that showed the rest of the country that jeans could be worn as casual wear, obviously. You know, from the sort of peg pant look of the 50s, you know, turning up the cuffs, through the major innovations of the 60s and early 70s, which were, of course, associated with the counterculture, and I'm talking about extreme bell bottoms, which were an idea borrowed from centuries-old Navy tradition. Actually, Navy's wearing bell bottoms have worn bell bottoms historically. And that's directly where that idea came from, in the Army-Navy stores. Jeans were sold with extreme bell-bottoms. And up through the designer jeans era of the later 70s and early 80s, where we saw for the first time jeans going upscale and also for the first time being worn by multiple generations, being worn by some of the same children of the 50s that had grown up in blue jeans. Now they were entering middle age and wanted their jeans to be slightly more upscaled, and that's where the designer jeans era comes into thinking. And then up through the 1990s, when we saw the hip-hop generation wear the extreme baggy look that got an awful lot of attention about 10 years ago, and more recently the what's called the low-rise look, which is the sort of provocatively low riding on the hips look of blue jeans, form-fitting, tight blue jeans, midriff exposing, you know, as I say, every generation has found a way to tweak them just enough to make them different than their parents' generation.
Yeah. Maybe here we should note that sex really has been part of the equation almost from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course,
there's no way around it. That's absolutely true.
We might recall the Calvin Klein ads of the 80s, more recently Abercrombie & Fitch ads and signage. But Brigham Young weighed in on jeans back in the 1830s.
Actually, this was a period, the 1830s, a period prior to the mass production of blue jeans. European peasants had been wearing denim work pants and overalls for decades, if not centuries, prior to the early 1800s. But they were not mass produced. They were not mass produced until, as I mentioned earlier, Levi Strauss began doing that in the 1870s. But when work pants in America were first, when they were first fashioned in such a way so that the buttons were no longer on the sides, on the hips, but rather in the front, where we now consider the fly to be, Brigham Young is supposed to have called them fornication pants. And to my mind, that really does sort of set in motion, you know, 150 years or more of popular thinking or unpopular thinking about the idea of blue jeans and work pants becoming casual wear. We've seen, you know, many of the styles that I just mentioned have come under the same sort of fire by certain groups who feel like it's improper for younger generations to wear their jeans in a certain way.
Yeah. One of the things you discuss early in the book is very interesting, the history of pants before the blue jean, and you report that once upon a time, full-length trousers were thought unfit for the parlor.
Mm-hmm.
How was it that full-length trousers gained respectability?
Well, they didn't gain particular respectability. They just sort of became so obviously practical that there was no way around them. In European culture, the aristocrats, of course, wore knee breeches or knickers, and it was only the peasant class, the working class, the farmers and peasants who wore full-length trousers for obviously reasons, for protection, you know, for the fact that they might have been on their hands and knees, that sort of thing. In America, it wasn't until really the early 19th century that full-length trousers became popular among classes other than the working class, both here and abroad. Actually, during the French Revolution, it became, for the first time that I can tell in history, full-length trousers became faddish as the revolutionaries took to wearing full-length pants in a show of solidarity with that working class that did, in fact, wear them prior. And in America, I found examples of English settlers writing letters back home in the late 18th century saying, you know, everyone over here wears full-length trousers. It's only practical because this is a wild land, and you know, we're clearing a lot of brush over here, essentially, and you know, it only makes sense to wear full-length trousers.
Yeah. So at this point, or now we can think of, when I've started to think about this, it's, you know, then it's little boys and women who are prevented from wearing full-length trousers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's very interesting. When did women begin wearing blue jeans?
You know, the I think we tend to think that the blue jean industry was essentially male-dominated for many decades, which it was, but there are instances as far back as World War I when companies like Levi Strauss and also the Lee Company and other regional workwear brands were realizing that there was a potential market there for women doing, and at the time what they did was they would explain, you know, if you're doing gardening or housework, you know, so they would describe a, you know, a chore, obviously, that would make sense to wear jeans in. Levi's, for instance, introduced a line called Lady Levi's, and Lee had similar products, but it wasn't really until the Second World War that the idea of women in jeans really took hold, and really from there forward the industry made a concerted effort rather than haphazard occasional efforts to market to women. And what World War II did, obviously, was introduced us to the character of Rosie the Riveter,
mm-hmm.
Where housewives and working women went to work in the factories as their employment roles were depleted by men going overseas to fight the war. And women more and more began wearing overalls and denim work pants for safety reasons and for practical reasons in the factories. And so it wasn't really until then that the rest of the American public became accustomed to women wearing jeans.
Yeah. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong now, but I think that in World War I, when there were some women working in factories, they were dressed, some of them, in things called womanalls.
That's right. Yeah. Sort of a coverall. in many cases, meant to be worn over what they were already wearing, what they already left the house wearing or something. But again, the innovations brought into the industry by the jeans manufacturers surrounding the world wars, the coveralls were not particularly popular after the war ended.
Yeah. What came first, the denim jean, the jean, or an overall? Or were they sort of...
I think it's impossible to know at this point which came first, although, as I mentioned earlier, European peasants were wearing rudimentary versions of both. Jeans, for many decades, in fact, until the early 1960s, Levi Strauss and company officially called the product waist overalls or waist-high overalls, which clearly means, overalls without the bib. It wasn't until right around 1960 that the Levi company realized that most of its customers were calling the product either dungarees or blue jeans, and they started calling them blue jeans officially at that point.
Yeah. Blue drillin's another name for blue jeans.
Yeah, that's an old-fashioned term. That's a one from the 19th century that refers to a fabric called drillin that was called at the time drillin, which sort of feeds into the idea that all of the terms for jeans tend to come from the material itself. The term jean actually originated with a lighter weight cotton cloth, lighter than denim, called jean cloth, which was pretty common in Europe and over here in America in the 18th and 19th centuries. It originated in Genoa, Italy, which is where the name comes from. And the term denim comes from the industrial town, the industrial French city of Nîmes, which produced something akin to denim, which was known as serge de Nîmes, which is obviously anglicized and shortened to the term denim.
Hmm. So it's an American and European.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of products of American culture, like most products of American culture, there are roots overseas. So although we think of jeans as this classic American product, and they certainly are, both because they were first mass-produced here and also because we've managed to create a brand image of this product as our own. There were origins, rudimentary origins, overseas in the old world.
Yeah. Now, before drillin', before denim, were there other tough fabrics? I'm thinking, maybe duck, mm-hmm. Or canvas or
exactly.
Corduroy. Were those fabrics worn by working folk?
Yeah, absolutely, all of those. The working classes in America in the 19th century wore wool pants as well. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine now. You know, you think of wool as, especially wool of that, dating back that far, as being uncomfortable and not practical and hot, yeah. But they did wear them. I mean, they wore, essentially the working classes in the 19th century wore whatever they could get their hands on. And when blue jeans first became mass-produced, it's part of the reason why they caught on as quickly as they did, because they were suddenly easy to come by in any size, and they were practical. They made sense. You know, when Levi Strauss first began producing jeans in the 1870s, they mass-produced them because the company had come up through a client of theirs, a tailor in Nevada, who had been buying denim from the Levi Strauss wholesale business for many years. This particular tailor, his name was Jacob Davis. He had come up with an innovation that he felt was a good one, where his customers were mostly miners in Nevada. They were complaining that their work pants were blowing out at the seams, and Jacob Davis added the copper rivets to the pockets and to the crotch and to other reinforcement areas to make the pants more durable. And when that innovation turned out to be a good one, this man was not particularly wealthy, and he went to his supplier, his denim supplier, which was Levi Strauss, and said, if you can pay the fee for the patent application, I'd be willing to let you take off with this idea and mass produce it. And that's exactly what happened. And Jacob Davis eventually went to San Francisco to operate the first Levi's jeans factory.
Yeah. Well, when I think of jeans, I think Levi's.
Mm-hmm.
But while they were in the business of mass producing the blue jeans in the 1870s, it was all but unknown eastward.
The company, right?
Yeah, it was a West Coast business.
Well, if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Levi's was one of many, many dozens of regional workwear companies operating until the early part of the 20th century, and that's because, like any other company, they were beholden to the railroads. They could only distribute their product by the railroads, so you couldn't overnight a shipment from one coast to the other. You needed to put it on a freight car, and it was going to get there when it was going to get there. So because of that, like most other industries, there was fierce competition regionally, so that the Levi Strauss Company was known up and down the West Coast for the first 50 years or so of its existence as a jeans manufacturer. But there was fierce competition on the West Coast from companies such as a San Francisco company called Can't Bust 'Em. There was a Los Angeles company called The Stronghold that was pretty well known in the early 20th century to Southern California workers. The Lee Company, beginning right around the turn of the 20th century, was founded in Kansas. And on the East Coast, there was, among others, there was this company called Sweetor in New York State, which was one of the biggest jeans companies of its day, although it went defunct a few decades ago and is no longer remembered particularly well. And then in North Carolina, there was the Bluebell Company, which was an amalgamation of a number of workwear companies that eventually that put out many different brands, eventually one of them being the Wrangler brand, which began in 1947. So for the first 75 years or so of their existence, jeans were manufactured by all kinds of companies all over the country, and almost all of them were only regionally known. One of the few nationally recognized brands was probably the Hercules brand, which was made by Sears, and that was nationally recognized because people purchased them out of the Sears catalog.
Mm. Also, here in the Midwest, Oshkosh B'gosh.
Sure, absolutely, right. So every region has its own. Texas had the Dickey Company. Every region had many different companies making blue jeans.
Yeah. Here's something that is very interesting to think about that you say in your book, Jeans, A Cultural History of an American Icon. Every accoutrement of the American lifestyle has been branded, and it started with the brands on our behinds.
Mm-hmm.
How did the various brands distinguish themselves?
Well, what they tried to do was to say, in the early years, when they were still considered workwear, was to say that they were more durable than the next guy's product. And one of the fascinating things that I found was that if listeners can picture what it looks like on the back, the brown patch on the back of a pair of Levi's, there's a drawing, an old-fashioned-looking drawing of two horses being led in different directions from each other, trying to tear apart a pair of blue jeans, of Levi's, and apparently failing to do so. Well, what I found through the help of some vintage denim collectors who have made it their life's work to study this sort of thing is that that was the some version of that kind of drawing was used by many, if not most, of the jeans companies of the 19th century. There were companies that had drawings or pictures in their advertising and on their on the patchwork on the back of the identifying brands on the backs of their jeans of two elephants being led apart and trying to rip apart a pair of jeans, of two locomotives, of two sets of men having a tug of war trying to pull apart a pair of jeans. That particular one was the image of used by the Sweetor Company in New York State that I mentioned. So it's actually unclear whether Levi's was the first to use it or not, that idea. But the way I came to understand it is that those images were used mostly because the working class at the time was largely made up of European immigrants, many of whom did not speak English particularly well, if at all. So what they were doing was, simply by showing a picture saying our product is durable, it's not going to rip, you can't rip it no matter what you do to it.
Yeah, you wouldn't even have to read at all.
Exactly.
even if you were an English speaker.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, you were talking about brand imaging and the idea of how they sold their product. And, you know, it wasn't really until the 1940s and 50s that the jeans industry realized that there was a whole other market out there for them, which was the casual wear market, the idea that young people who were not necessarily working in, you know, hard labor jobs were wearing their product. And then what they did, you know, did was they actually, in many ways, taught the rest of the consumer goods industry how to do brand imaging, how to create an image for your own brand. And the jeans companies did that by, you know, in the case of Wrangler, attempting to show and doing a good job with it that these were the classic jeans worn by cowboys. If you wanted to be a sort of a throwback to the Wild West or a cowboy, you wore Wranglers, and Levi's and other companies projected the image that if you were a cool kid in the 50s, a teenager in the 50s, part of your own budding rock and roll culture, that you would wear a pair of Levi's. So the idea of brand imaging, generally speaking, I think can be traced back in much the same way that the idea of sex and advertising can be traced back to mm-hmm. those ads of the 70s, the very risque blue jeans ads of the 70s. I think that brand imaging can be traced back to the blue jeans industry as one of the pioneers.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that the blue jean is at once all-American and outlaw?
Mm-hmm.
It can be, you know, clean cut, you know,
mm-hmm.
sharp,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, or it can tell you a whole different story about somebody.
Right, and oddly enough, there, you know, even in this day and age, when people pay exorbitant amounts of money for premium jeans, and they have essentially gone upscale to the point where people wear them to, you know, stars wear them to red carpet events, and you know, entire magazines are devoted to what stars are wearing which jeans, and you know, people wear them to the office today, and all that sort of stuff. They do still project a little bit of a rebellious image. I mean, although everybody else seems to be wearing blue jeans, you know, when we wear blue jeans, I think we all tend to think of ourselves as, you know, there's a little bit of creativity, a little bit of rebellious attitude there, which are classic American attitudes. And that's, one of the ways that they've managed to not just last but thrive as a fashion category.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is James Sullivan, author of Jeans, A Cultural History of an American Icon. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, we all wear blue jeans. I think I maybe know one person who has never set foot in a pair of blue jeans. And you say this is a nice thought. We are never more ourselves than when we are wearing our favorite pair. It's an American uniform, yet it is such an individual choice.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to ask you, what's your favorite pair?
Well, I'm sort of a classic Levi's loyalist. That's the way I grew up, and that's the way my wife tells me that I tend to be loyalty is one of my best qualities, and I certainly am that when it comes to what I wear. Although I will say that because I, you know, spent a lot of time researching the subject, you know, I came to it from the cultural and historical standpoint more so than from the fashion standpoint.
Uh-huh.
But in the process of the research, and certainly in writing a book about blue jeans, I, you know, needed to bring myself up to speed with as much of the fashion aspect of it as I possibly could. And so if I've become something of an expert on blue jeans fashion, I've felt compelled recently to try on a few pairs of the premium jeans, the jeans that are, you know, sort mm-hmm. of, you know, $150, $200 and up. And I have a couple pairs of those at this point, both of which actually happen to be the designers have concepts that they claim to be based on very classic, old-school style workwear jeans, and yet these are premium jeans. One's called Farmer. It's a small company based in L.A. The other one is called Purpose. It's PRPS, and it's designed by a Japanese designer who's very much vintage, classic vintage minded, and I love both of those pairs as well. But I still, you know, the everything else that's in my drawer of, in my pants drawer is classic Levi's 501s.
Yeah. Just like my husband, I can't remember the number he wears, but he's got to have his Levi, whatever it is,
right,
501
exactly.
Or 302 or whatever it is. I don't remember.
Right.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let's talk with some listeners now. Our first caller this afternoon in Arcola on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Very interesting program. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the 501 gene, which is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And also talk about the company Levi's a little bit. I know they switched, or I had heard something about they had moved their manufacturing to another country and so forth. And I was just kind of interested to know how they're doing as a company and what are they still like the leader in jeans? Or I know there's a lot of competition. And I'll hang up.
Thanks for the question.
There certainly is a lot of competition. A lot of the attention in the last few years has been paid to the premium brands, as I just mentioned. But the fact of the matter is that all of those premium brands are almost all of them are independently owned and operated, and most of them are operating at minuscule levels still compared to a giant like Levi Strauss. Levi Strauss, for all of its recent disappointments, it remains. The 800-pound gorilla in the industry, and everybody recognizes that fact. In fact, a lot of the premium designers that I talked to in the course of writing the book went ahead and said, you know, they've all their lives considered the 501 to be the gold standard of the industry, even as they're designing jeans that are almost meant not to compete at all with the 501, that are meant to compete with other $200, ultra fancy, ultra swanky kind of blue jeans. They still can, all the designers still consider the 501 to be the classic, the gold standard of the industry. The 501 dates back to the 1890s, at a time when Levi Strauss, when the company was making blue jeans, every couple of years or so there'd be a slight variation. They'd add another pocket, or they would, add or remove the buckle back in the back, or they added belt loops at one point when it was determined that men were moving away from wearing suspenders. And by the 1890s, the classic 501, the button fly, riveted five pocket design, five pockets meaning obviously two in front, two in back, and then the small watch pocket, which is the little one that people tend to think of as the useless pocket in the front. but which has remained a part of blue jeans design ever since. The little watch pocket, or the little pocket rather, is called the watch pocket. And if when you hear the name, you realize for obvious reasons it was designed at a time when men wore their watches on chains, not on their wrists, and that's where you would fit it in if you weren't wearing a jacket or an overall bib with pockets in it or something. That's where you could fit your watch.
Yeah, and I think we're rapidly approaching a time where some younger people might ask, "What's a watch?"
True, very true.
Yeah.
But I think the pocket will remain on even the most modern blue jeans, just because that's the classic design and that's what people continue to do. The caller asked about the company. Well, I think that actually Levi Strauss is turning a bit of a corner right now. Things do seem to be looking up for them a little bit. I mean, it's been about 10 years since they started reporting a downturn in annual revenues. They reached a peak of about $8 billion about 10 years ago. And they were really at an apex. They were really thriving as a company. And then suddenly it seemed like a sudden shift. One thing that happened was all the other companies realized that the hip-hop crowd was and kids who emulated them were wearing very baggy blue jeans. And Levi's had always been slow to accede to trends like the baggy look of the early to mid-1990s. The Levi's always felt like they made a classic product and they should stick with it. And the baggy blue jean thing was extremely big for a few years. And it stuck around long enough that it really hurt the Levi company, because they started to take on an image in the marketplace as the sort of Johnny Come Lately. They finally did start marketing lines of jeans that were meant to be oversized, loose fitting, and by that point, people had the impression that they were sort of jumping on the bandwagon late, and it really hurt the business. And they spent many years. They recently went into the Walmart company after resisting for many years with a low line called the Signature product, which is like a sort of like a cut rate version of Levi's, specifically made for the Walmart customer who's looking for value, and they're cheap. They're about $20. So people criticized them then for watering down the good name of Levi's in the product. So it's only been recently when they're sort of refocusing on marketing their classic products again and upscaling them once again that I think they've finally maybe turned a corner.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Yes, I have an interesting historical question for you.
Sure.
You've used the words jeans and overalls and so on, and many, many times you've used another word that you haven't really said anything about, namely blue.
All right.
I was curious to know. I knew a little bit about a company in New Jersey, Thomas Oakes and Company, which went back to almost to the War of 1812, mm-hmm. and they manufactured woolens, and everything they did was blue,
mm-hmm.
and they got a contract to do the police force of the city of New York,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know, the people over there wanted something else, and Mr. Oakes said, "You got to be blue."
Mm.
And in the Civil War, I think you remember what color the uniforms were of
mm-hmm.
the Union Army?
Mm-hmm.
Blue.
Sure.
It's my understanding that this is because woolens take indigo more easily, or indigo is more available, or what? What is your findings on
that? Well, with regard to denim, cotton and indigo actually have a unique relationship to each other. Unlike just about any other dye and fabric relationship, when you think of dyeing a fabric, you think that you kind of have this image in your mind that it's saturated, that it gets soaked, not unlike if you were to put it in water. But what actually happens with indigo is that the way it interacts with cotton fabric is that it does not saturate the product. It sits on top, essentially. So the more times you dip the fabric into dye, additional layers build up on top of the fabric, not saturating it, but just on top. So what happens is that with blue jeans, as they get worn and or washed, the indigo that has been built up by dyeing on top of the fabric, the denim fabric, eventually abrades away. Whether it's from our hands, the oils in our body, the washing process when we do wash them, and that's where fading comes from. Indigo, or rather denim, is made with one dyed and one undyed thread. The cross thread is undyed, so that as the indigo abrades off of the product, it reveals the white underneath, and that's where we get the classic fading of blue jeans from. And with regard to the history of blue, one thing that I learned in the research for the book is that indigo dye is one of the oldest dyes known to man, and for thousands of years, actually, cultures all across the globe have dressed their working classes in blue, some form of blue clothing. So historically, working classes have always been associated with blue clothing, mainly simply because indigo was widely known and essentially easy to get. So it's not particularly coincidental that our own classic working class garment, blue jeans, is blue, because the working class garments of other cultures for centuries has been blue.
Yes, and then I wonder how many different fabrics were available before, say, 1850. I mean, not very many.
Now, there were more than you'd imagine. There were all kinds of variations on cotton and wool and blends, fustian. There were actually all kinds. Blue jeans themselves were made before the mass production era. Blue jeans were made out of jean cloth, as I mentioned earlier, which was a much lighter weight cotton. They were made out of duck. They were made out of canvas, many different products. They weren't called blue jeans yet, but they were workwear similarly designed. And it was only when they started being mass produced that denim really sort of rose to the top as the obvious, the most comfortable and yet most durable material to make the product out of.
Very interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good question. And another thing, though, that comes up is that as human beings, we are drawn to the color blue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So while we have all these jeans in all different kinds of colors, blue remains our favorite.
Right. In studying just the psychology of color, blue is the one color that has as wide a range of emotions associated with it as it does. Most other colors in our minds, whether it's black or red or white, they have a much narrower range of emotions. Blue can mean, in the right circumstances, blue can mean all things to all people. Mm. It can mean good moods and bad moods. It can mean the sky and the sea. It can mean all kinds of things. And so I think that's maybe yet another key to why blue jeans have been so durable, that they happen to be made in the color that, is most mysterious and most appealing to us.
Well, let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. In your research, did you see any discussion about age limits for wearing jeans? I'm 70. My husband, who's English, would never think of wearing jeans, but he talks about my being too old to wear them, but I wear them anyway.
And good for you.
Not anymore. I mean, I think that we've, since the 50s, we've understood that every generation since that time has grown up wearing jeans and never stopped, beginning with the baby boom generation, jeans were no longer considered to be strictly for young people or the working class. They were for everybody. As far as economics go, they were for, they went upscale in the 70s. And as far as age groups go, the age group that were kids or teenagers in the 50s grew up wearing them and continues to wear them today. I'm going to guess that if your husband is English, the working classes and the young people who associated with the working classes of the period between the wars mostly wore corduroy. That was their working class garment, which is a little bit unusual because it was British textile mills that actually first began exporting denim and jean cloth to the Americas 200 years ago and more. To the best of my knowledge, the period between the wars when blue jeans were taking off with young people in America, their British counterparts were wearing corduroys.
That's right. Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line three. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My mom was absolutely, I'm 71, adamant against blue jeans, and she had a real phobia about that. Now it's kind of the way you dress classy. Anyhow, can you comment on that? I have not read your book, but that's a fascinating subject.
Well, thank you.
I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, that kind of a juvenile delinquent kind of image, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, when jeans became so popular for kids, there was this, it was sort of a two sides to that coin for the jeans industry. I mean, on the one hand, Levi Strauss and Lee and the other companies were excited that this whole new market had opened up for them. And on the other hand, it caused headaches for them because the parents of those same young people in the 50s and the educators, their teachers, both felt widely that blue jeans were not appropriate for good kids, and that they were to be associated with juvenile delinquency, and it was a real problem. I mean, there was a campaign waged by schools across the country banning blue jeans, and parents telling their kids that they couldn't wear them because if they did, they looked like a juvenile delinquent. It was a real problem for the industry, to the point that the cotton industry banded together and formed something that eventually became known as the Denim Council, which was essentially a public service advertising group meant to offset the idea specifically to offset the idea that good kids could wear jeans as well, because those campaigns against blue jeans were hurting the cotton industry and the denim industry to such an extent that they felt like they had to say something about it. So they came back with ads, explaining to mothers that blue jeans were actually a great option for their family because they were durable, they were great value, and they were machine washable. So, it was an interesting time.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
Yes. This came up in conversation last week, the origin and derivative of the term dungaree.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't have the answer for this, but if you do, I'd be happy to listen. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Simple answer. Dungaree is yet another. It's based on yet another variation on cotton cloth that was used for work clothing hundreds of years ago, which originated in a region of India known as Dungaree, which is a slightly different spelling, D-U-N-G-R-I, but that's where the name comes from.
Very interesting. Well, back to the idea of blue jeans being at once outlaw and all-American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think of, here's something, I think it should interest you, is, movies and music and television. And, when you start to think of movies featuring denim clothing, mm-hmm. you go back to Westerns like Stagecoach. But mm-hmm. then in the 50s, you get, The Wild One,
mm-hmm.
Rebel Without a Cause in the 60s, The Misfits,
mm-hmm.
Jailhouse Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Then with television, though, it seemed that blue jeans sort of were rehabilitated with Lucy and Desi,
mm-hmm.
and Ricky Nelson.
Right. And Happy Days. In large part, blue jeans, when they're portrayed on TV or they're portrayed in, sort of wholesome, classic 50s style American values, American Graffiti and Happy Days, obviously reviving the 50s for the generation that was growing up in the 70s, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And recently we've had another film where actually blue jeans have a starring role, The Sisterhood of the Traveling
right.
Pants.
Exactly.
Starring
right.
Thrift Shop Jeans.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
The girls who share their favorite pair of thrift shop jeans over the course of the summer and what happens to them while they're sharing those jeans over the summer, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got to wrap it up here. Speaking of music, I do have, there are so many lyrics out there, and as you talk about in your book, there are also all kinds of album art
mm-hmm.
out there featuring blue jeans, but I have a classic blue jean tune that I think would be appropriate to go out with this afternoon, Blue Jean Blues, ZZ Top, the
mm-hmm.
artists, and there we'll leave it. And our thanks this afternoon, James Sullivan, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
James Sullivan is the author of Jeans, A Cultural History of an American Icon, the publisher, Gotham Books.
I done ran into my baby and finally found my old blue jeans. I done ran into my baby and finally found my old blue jeans. Well, I could tell that day was mine from the oil and the gasoline. Thank you.
Blue Jean Blues, ZZ Top. And you know, when he gets those blue jeans back, he gets the woman back, too. There you have it. Jeans, a cultural history of an American icon. James Sullivan was our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine.